يقولون سلام سلام ولا هنا سلام.
You're listening to Middle East Analysis, a podcast series from the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales. Hello and welcome to Middle East Analysis. And it's been a fair while, as often it is during these times of summer season and people getting away and so forth. Time doesn't wait for us, though, in the Middle East, of course, and there's been lots going on. Before I went away in particular, Syria looked on the brink. It looked like Assad's regime was going to crumble and fall very, very quickly. That hasn't quite been the case, but our regular studio guest, Dr. Harry Hagopian, will bring us up to speed on that. Goings on in Lebanon, Egypt, we've got a word or two to say on Tunisia, and who can forget the Olympics? I know we're going to be moving on to the Paralympics fairly shortly, but the great celebration that was London 2012, and there are things to say about the Middle East, North Africa region there as well. Now, I alluded to it a matter of seconds ago, but I'm joined by Dr. Harry Hagopian, lawyer, ecumenical, political, just fingers in all sorts of pies, and a very competent man. Harry, how are you?
It's a pleasure, James, to be back. It has been weeks and weeks. And interestingly enough, summer is a silly season. But for some reason, London didn't appear to be in the middle of a silly season this year, perhaps because of the Olympics Games.
What serious sporting prowess on that agenda.
It was. I mean, for 2 weeks, it was incredible. You opened any channel on the television, you listened to the radio from the most intellectual programs like Today all the way to the BBC World Service. And instead of getting headlines from the world, it was always, this is the medal tally today. This is what we've done today.
Well, you know, having said that, that's all very true. And ladies and gentlemen, you can't see Harry Hagopian doing a Mobot here, paying homage to Mo Farah. We'll talk about that a little bit later. But, you know, a serious second story, and maybe it should have been a first story in many ways, was the Al-Assad regime in Syria, supposedly on its knees, defections all over the shop. It will crumble in days, I read on one of them before I went away for 2 weeks, and things don't appear to have quite moved at that speed. So can we start with Syria, and can you bring us up to date, Harry?
Yeah, I think it's pretty much the same since you left on your holidays, James. It's been a very, very bad place. Now the fighting has spread all over the country. Aleppo, which is the second city, and it's the business and commercial hub of Syria, is also engulfed in battles between the Free Syrian Army and the regular Syrian Army. If you go to one of the districts or neighborhoods of Syria, Salah al-Din, then it is absolutely devastated from all the attacks against it. So yeah, the violence continues, the carnage continues, the death toll continues, the pain and grief continues. And yet the stalemate also continues internationally as well as locally. And it is almost like there is a standoff where both sides are not winning, but both sides are not losing either. And therefore, as we continue with this standoff, the agony continues until such time as inevitably, I believe, that the Assad regime will fall, not only necessarily because of the defections, whether they're high profile or low profile, but because there is a momentum to these things. The regular army is spread out too thinly across the country. The morale of the army and the political establishment is beginning to get increasingly more beleaguered. And I think there is a general feeling in the air that not in a few days' time, perhaps not also in a few weeks' time, but eventually we cannot continue with the way we are, and inevitably something has to give. Today, for instance, the meetings that took place in Saudi Arabia of the Islamic Conference repeated the same thing. Everybody you talk to is saying that something has to give. And meanwhile, the viciousness continues. And unfortunately, with the viciousness and the violence, the radicalism on both sides also mounts up, which is something that concerns me as much as the violence itself.
And I know, you know, things are moving quickly, but just a quick word on Kofi Annan. We said the plan was on its knees.
Do you remember how many, many weeks and months ago you and I sat in this same studio and we said that the Kofi Annan plan is a non-starter? Mm. It was a non-starter then. He finally acknowledged that it is a non-starter and gave it up. Now, there was a lot of talk in the United Nations corridors to put Lakhdar Ebrahimi, who is a very veteran, skillful Algerian diplomat who has had a lot of success in the Afghanistan situation and in the Lebanon situation during the civil war, to take over from him. Now, I hope he doesn't, because if he does, he's not going to make any more difference than Kofi Annan did. So that kind of international diplomacy is not working. The Syrian opposition is in disarray to some extent, which is why they can't get their act together. But eventually, I think we have to find a way forward, because the country cannot sustain this anymore. And if I grieve for anybody, I grieve for the millions of Syrians who are caught up in this violence in a country that was once probably the quietest and most interesting countries in the heartland of the Arab world, being devastated at the moment. The stories I hear, James, the people who call me, the people I call and still manage to talk to in Aleppo, remember, I'm Armenian and there is a huge Armenian community in Aleppo. Mm. So I'm talking to them. Some of them are leaving and going to Armenia temporarily. Others are pretty feeling desolate about it, but they're only a microcosm of a wider reality that applies to Muslims, Christians, Druze, Ismailis and Kurds alike.
And with regard to international diplomacy, you said this type of international diplomacy hasn't worked. Is that dead as well?
This type of international diplomacy will not work. The whole idea of international diplomacy is that we have to have something happening on the international level. This is the whole nature of diplomacy. You can't say there is a vacuum. You can't say the international community has washed its hands off Syria. So we pretend we are doing something. So U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton makes a statement here or there. There is a meeting here or there. But it is becoming quite clear that that in itself is not going to resolve the situation. And if you look at what is happening strategically in Syria and around Syria, then you can see that the neighbors such as Turkey, such as Iraq, such as Jordan, which is being very, very much affected by the flow of refugees and some clashes even at the borders between Syrians and Jordanians, all this is beginning to create a head of steam. And I think at some stage politically, there is going to be a tipping point. We have talked of tipping points before. The international pundits have talked about many tipping points. I don't think we have peaked yet, unfortunately, but a peak will happen. When that happens, I think we will see an end to the Assad regime and its replacement by something. What exactly is not yet clear. And the whole hope, the whole skill of politics and diplomacy is that that something that replaces the Assad regime will be cohesive and coherent enough to take the institutions of Syria forward rather than ending up into an Iraqi situation of total bedlam.
Well, you're a conflict expert in certain senses, Harry. We talked about Iraq and not having a sort of post-conflict plan and a vacuum. And, you know, what is the sort of, who's on the periphery? I'm not asking you to be a prophet. I'm asking you to just tell me a bit about, you know, will there be a vacuum? What might fill it? Can you give us a bit of an overview?
In this instance, I don't need to be a prophet to say, James, that there are lots of efforts being deployed, efforts in Berlin, in Germany, efforts in the United Nations, elsewhere across the world. People are sitting together and thinking of a post-Assad situation for Syria. People have learned lessons from Iraq. And I think the Iraqi situation, much as it frightens everybody, and much as you and I have spoken and I have expressed my opinion about what an ill-fated invasion that was, I think there are differences between Iraq and Syria, because in Iraq it was an occupation by a foreign force, otherwise us. against a local Arab indigenous country. In this case, it is not the case. In this situation, it is Syrians themselves fighting to liberate their country from authoritarianism and autocracy and replace one system of repression by another, hopefully more democratic system. So the symmetry is not there in that sense. But the other also that is quite clear to my mind is that in Syria, the institutions are there. And it is surprising how, after 18 months almost, we're into our 17th month now of conflict, how civil society and NGOs have been performing remarkably well in trying to help Syrians across the whole country, north, south, east, and west. So in a sense, the infrastructure and institutions are there. And what we should avoid doing in Syria is what we did in Iraq, where we dismantled the army, where we dismantled those institutions and thought we could build them all up again the way we thought we should do it. That was the death knell for Iraq. And in Syria, I think people have learned that, and they're going to use the existing structures in order to build up a better Syria and move it forward. And I'll give you one very simple example for our listeners. People say about the army, when you talk about the army, people say, well, how can you rely on this army? This is the army that has killed almost, we have 20,000 people dead now in Syria. That's been shelling, killing, bombing, strafing civilians and lightly armed people. How can we use this army as part of a post-Assad future for Syria? My answer to that is very simple. The Syrian army consists of 13 or 14 brigades, out of which only 3 or 4 at most have been used during this whole 17-month period and have directed their arms against the people. Now, you might ask me why, if Assad is in such a bad situation, why doesn't he deploy the whole formidable arsenal that he has at his disposal? The reason is he's deploying those brigades and those soldiers whom he trusts, whereas the other ones, he's worried that they might defect, and therefore they're being kept in their barracks. Those are people there who have not blooded their hands with the deaths of Syrians and the injuries of Syrians. These are the people who will then be the backbone of Syria, who will work with the institutions, with the civil structure of the country, with the new pluralistic, hopefully, political setup in order to take Syria out of the mud and into a better future.
I'm going to digress very slightly, Harry. It's a very interesting point, that last one. But you're sounding a bit gravelly, a bit like the Marlborough man, maybe the Cohiba man, because I know you like a cigar. Are you all right over there?
I do like a cigar every now and then. Yes, I'm just being gravelly. I thought it makes me sound more intellectual.
If indeed that is possible. No, well, I will move on then. Before
Please.
We go into something of a regional analysis, which I will ask you, because it's been a while since we've done one of these podcasts. Women from the Middle East, North Africa region and the Olympics. I think there's a bit to talk about there.
I was delighted by that. You know, I'm not the best sportsman at the best of times. I'm not somebody who sits glued in front of his television screen wondering how many microseconds quicker one competitor would get to the finishing line than somebody else. I'm not that kind of person. I have my own preferences, but I'm not an enthusiast in that sense that I get completely taken over by Olympics mania. However, there are some things that I enjoyed thoroughly during those 2 weeks, and I was proud by the fact that Team GB came third. I think we basically pulled way above our abilities, and I was so happy with that. But for me, you know, what really, really mattered to me are two things. And I know you're going to smile, James, because you know me fairly well by now over the years. One, I was so proud that there were women participants from the Middle East and North Africa. Arab women from Saudi Arabia, competitors like Samar Attar, people from Bahrain, like Maryam Youssef, who actually won a bronze medal. People from Libya, like Lelia Giza. others who were there, who not only for the first time broke some taboos within their own societies and came and competed with their peers. I thought that was really good, but that was also a very, very good achievement against the misogyny and the inbred disempowerment of women in those societies. To see those women coming, even if they were veiled, even if they had to have headscarves, even if they didn't really win many medals in the 800 meters, for instance, the Saudi competitor came last. It doesn't matter. What matters is that a few glass ceilings were broken. And I was very happy to see that, if nothing else, then we have forced the hands of largely male decision makers in those countries to send women to represent their societies. That, to me, was one thing that I was very proud of. The other thing that I was very proud of, and I loved Mo Farah's victory. I mean, that was good. The man is so nice. He's very charismatic. He smiles. He laughs. But it's not only the fact that I liked him or I was happy that he won, but for me, it was also a success in what we keep talking about in this country, multiculturalism, multiculturalism. Who is Mo Farah? Mo Farah stands for Muhammad Farah. He is a Muslim, and a Muslim is somebody every single Olympics fan in the United Kingdom encouraged him to win. And therefore, that to me was something that broke another glass ceiling, that there was no Islamophobia, that there was nothing, that sport actually overran all those prejudices. And I was very happy with that.
I couldn't agree more, Harry, absolutely. Now, we're nearing the end somewhat, but I do think it's only right that you give us something of a regional analysis. Now, you mentioned earlier the neighbours of Syria. You mentioned Turkey, obviously refugee mm-hmm. issue there. You mentioned Lebanon, Jordan. Give us a little bit about where we're at right now in some of those countries.
Well, I'll try and give you a little bit of a highlight, James, because there are too many neighbours with too many things happening across the region. But one of the most important things, I think, is happening in Egypt. I think Egypt, since the revolution, we have seen the birth of the Second Republic. Egypt now is coming on its own. It's gradually beginning to fumble its way towards some sort of stability. Nobody exactly knows where it's going yet. But President Morsi, who hails from the Muslim Brotherhood, and everybody was worried about what he would have as designs in his mind for the country. And mind you, some people are still worried about his future plans, and not only the Coptic Christian communities in Egypt, but many other people. However, what he did is he managed a couple of master strokes against the military council, and he managed to strengthen his position, and in other words, the position of the presidency vis-à-vis the military council. Now, Egyptians have a very ambivalent reaction to the army and to the presidency. They like both. They like the military because it makes them feel secure. They like the presidency because it represents that sense of democracy. However, the military had, in my opinion, over-exceeded its remit since the overthrow of Hosni Mubarak, and it had gone around dismantling committees, adding to the constitution, deciding that it is the last resort for any decisions to be taken in Egypt. What Morsi did is he basically recentered the power around the presidency as it should be. Now, my only worry at the moment is, much as this is good because it shows that the levers of power are going away from the military toward a civilian administration, which is what we understand as democracy in the West, and this is a good thing. However, we have to be careful that what happens is that we do not disempower completely the military only to re-empower completely the presidency in the form of the Muslim Brotherhood. In other words, we should make sure that the future of Egypt is inclusive and it includes the secular, liberal wings of Egyptian society, Christians and Muslims alike, as much as it does the Freedom Party, the Muslim Brotherhood, as well as the military. This is for Egypt. So it's something to watch, but it's something also to feel that maybe things are moving forward. If, and I know you're a Twitter account follower, if you looked at the Twitter messages or at the blogosphere in Egypt, it was full of people saying, wonderful, the present is coming to its own, the country is coming. Egyptians are very proud of their country. So in a sense, there was that pride to be felt. So for me, Egypt is very important. Tunisia is also important to watch for the simple reason that I've always said that Tunisia led the way in terms of the so-called Arab Spring. And yes, it was Bouazizi was where it started. It's where the whole Arab revolutions, uprisings and rebellions started. However, what is very interesting is that there has been a slight regression in the ideas of the revolution in Tunisia, not least with the concerns about the disempowerment of women. Now, we have the Ennahda party and the Islamist party, which is pretty much the one deciding what happens in Tunisia. And women in Tunisia are at the moment campaigning for their rights. And I think because there is a little bit of ambiguity about the role of women within Tunisian society, are they equal to men under the law, or are they complementary to men under the law? This is the discussion that's happening now between equality and complementarity, and therefore they mean two entirely different things if you look at it from a legal jurisprudential manner. And there are again lots and lots of women in Tunisia campaigning to make sure that their own secular rights as women are preserved in a new Tunisia. In Lebanon at the moment, I think what is happening are political ructions because a very powerful former minister in the Lebanese government, who is also known to be very closely aligned to the Assad regime in Syria, has been arrested on charges of importing bombs or conspiring to cause explosions in the country. And that has actually mobilized the whole country because it is so unusual for this kind of arrest to take place or for the judicial authorities to act on this. So this is something that is very, very interesting. The minister is Michel Smeha, and the question is, what is going to happen to him? And is it the tip of the iceberg? Are more stories going to come about Syrian involvement in Lebanese affairs? Don't forget that there's so many Lebanese noted politicians and journalists, not least Rafi El Hariri, the prime minister, not least Samir Kassir, one of the icons of democracy and freedom in the country, not least people like Hawi and others who've been killed. So is it the tip of the iceberg? Are we witnessing a new reality dawning upon Lebanon, or will this be contained? Not least, James, at a time when Lebanon is also, at least in theory, getting ready to receive Pope Benedict XVI, who visits the country next month in September, in mid-September. So in that sense, lots of anticipation, lots of things happening across the whole region. Let me throw in Palestine there, and particularly Hamas in Gaza. You might have heard about the attack in the Sinai Peninsula in Egypt. Well, what happened is that there is talk that Islamists in Gaza had something to do with it. So there are tensions now between Gaza and the Hamas government there and Egypt. And interestingly enough, for me as an analyst of the situation, is that Hamas is an arm of the Muslim Brotherhood, as is the presidency on Egypt. So are two brothers now fighting? Very interesting things happening, which are worth following up in future podcasts, I think.
And then on top of that, of course, the Israelis almost praising Egypt for finally getting to grips with the Sinai region.
Exactly. And of course, the problem with the Sinai region or the peninsula is that the Camp David Accords had actually demilitarized the Sinai. So Egypt did not really have the authority under the Camp David Treaty to put any military presence in the peninsula. How can you regulate? How can you govern? How can you oversee a vast stretch of the desert if you're not allowed to have your people in there. So interesting times ahead. So even in summer, even in August, James, even during what some people might think is the silly season, or people like yourself who are away on holidays and come back with a deep, healthy tan, things have been happening in the MENA region, and I hope some of those things will be good things for the future.
Well, massive food for thought and lots to look at in the coming weeks. Now, Harry, I know you yourself are potentially going to the region at some point in the coming weeks, but let's see if we can catch up with you prior to Pope Benedict's visit to Lebanon so we can look at some of these issues, get to grips with some of these issues and how they're moving. And also for our listeners out there, yes, Dr. Harry Hagopian did allude to his presence on Twitter, and you can find him at Harry Hagopian, just as it sounds. You can also listen to these podcasts and go back over the incredibly eventful last 18 months on catholicnews.org.uk/middle-east-analysis and epectasis.net. Harry, your
and
very
epectasis.net, my own website, which has a lot of my articles and writing, some of which you sometimes kindly put on the homepage of our Bishops' Conference page as well. And finally, if I may finish off or conclude, James, I hope that between today and next mid-September, we have 4 weeks, so we will be able to have another podcast. But perhaps it is time also to wish today, 15th of August, all our listeners a happy Feast of the Assumption. It is one of the, in my opinion, one of the important feasts, because it is a feast that, unlike many others, is not solely Christ-centered, but also centered around the Mother of Jesus. And to me, that is a very, very important feast, not least since we spoke for a few minutes about the empowerment of women in the Middle East and North Africa. And interestingly enough, although we in the West call it the Feast of the Assumption, in other words, when the Virgin Mary was assumed into heaven, in Eastern churches and in the Arab world, we don't call it the Feast of the Assumption. We call it the Feast of Our Lady's Dormition. In other words, she was sleeping, which is one of the stories, that she was sleeping and then she was raised to heaven. So in the East, when you talk, you don't talk about assumptions, you talk about dormition. And of course, for all of our listeners who have been to Israel and Palestine, they will probably have seen one of the most beautiful churches, the Church of the Dormition in Jerusalem. And you have, if you haven't, it is a must. It's a beautiful church to visit.
A font of all knowledge, as always, Harry, with a few little tourism suggestions at the end there. Much appreciated. Thanks for your time.
Pleasure.
And we'll be seeing you very, very soon. That's it for today's Middle East analysis. But do stick with us on catholicnews.org.uk, or indeed, follow Harry on Twitter. Follow us, Catholic EW, on Twitter. And we'll be back with Middle East analysis in a few weeks.